another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Adam Short, host of the Grit in the Wild podcast. Adam, it's good to be back and to talk about prophets and prophecy. I was thinking, as you were mentioning what we were going to talk about today, I was thinking about how much this has the single topic has impacted my life so much, and the lives of those around me, and the frame of reference that we have for prophets and prophecy is just so vastly different than the rest of Christianity. And anyway, this is your topic. I'll let you run with it, but I just want to say that for me, this impacted me in a significant way, and I'm still trying to work to detangle what it was that they put in my head.
Wow. Yeah, I'm curious to hear more about your experience, John. But yeah, the phrase that came to mind, and it could be a new phrase, I don't know if other people have used this phrase, but what I thought is most appropriate to call this is retroactive prophecy. And then to sort of build upon that, it's kind of like Back to the Future, right? The movie Back to the Future. And I think what I mean by that is there are so many examples, especially here recently, I'd say recent being in the past 5 years, particularly as these high-profile prophetic people in the NAR, people like Chris Vallotton and others who have, Jeremiah Johnson's another one that comes to mind, who they've made specific prophecies about political events, right? Some of those being around the elections. And it's so interesting to me, if you go and look at this from a current event standpoint and a historical slash timeline standpoint, this is what they do. They'll come out, let's say today, July 25th, they come out and they announce that they had this vision. I had a vision. I had a dream 3 months ago that John Collins and Adam Short would do a podcast on July 25th. But they announced the dream and the vision that they had after they had it and after the event was supposed to happen so that they can validate the very event that they purportedly foretold. So it's kind of like you've got to jump back and forth on the historical timeline to make this stuff make sense. But I look back on my experience in hypercharismatic church and I realized how normal it was for my brain to just accept it at face value, right? So like you hear a leader giving a prophetic experience they had, they give the experience after the event supposedly was fulfilled in their prophecy. So I think your question is very pertinent. Like, how do you know if the leader had the actual, maybe they had the actual vision, but maybe they interpreted their vision or dream based on the actual events that really happened and said, hey, I'm right, because what I prophesied or what I experienced and now I'm prophesying was this, this, and this, and it actually happened. So I'm validating it's like a feedback loop that just never ends. It's like this, you know what I'm saying? So it's 100% validation of the data because they get to interpret it exactly how they choose to because they're retroactively, I don't know if this makes sense, but they're looking back retroactively about an experience they had that then supposedly was foretold. So best thing I can call it is retroactive prophecy, John. So I don't know if that made any sense at all.
It does. A lot of people call it prophecy after the fact. I grew up in this weird world where I get to be around some of the quote-unquote spiritually elite. And this is fascinating to me, this subject, because it's so far more complicated than people realize. It isn't just simply that some guy randomly, or a girl, randomly claims prophecy on something in the past. There's a lot more to it than that, and there's a lot more people involved than that. One of the most powerful tools of persuasion, and you can get this if you read some psychology books, I got it from reading a book by Sigmund Freud's nephew, what was his name, Bernays, I think it was. It's a book on mass psychology, how you can achieve mass psychology. One of the techniques is you actually the best technique, if you can give people breadcrumbs to where they can come to their own conclusion rather than you giving them that conclusion, they will believe it for a lifetime. But if you try to force your opinion and force your conclusion on them, they just kind of step back and they say, wait a minute, let me think about this first. And they may not adopt that opinion. So as a tool of persuasion, you leave breadcrumbs and you lead people there. Well, complicate that even further by the cult mindset. You have a bunch of people who are manipulated already to see things that aren't there, to try to grasp things that aren't yet fulfilled, and try to lift a single person or group of people into a spiritual plane that is higher than themselves. So they're expecting something that isn't there. What happens is you get these people who, I was around people who were quote unquote prophetic, and they would say things like, we'd be at a ball game and they would say things like, you just watch, the Chiefs are going to win this game. And to the casual person, like if I were to say that, you would say, if I was wrong, you'd say, see, John, you're wrong. The Chiefs didn't win. And if I was right, you'd go, oh, wow, you called it. I mean, it would be that simple. But when you're in this mindset, what happens is those people who hear it, they go home and they think that there's some big expectation by God. Oh, God must be surrounding this game of the Chiefs. We all need to watch it. And so then it turns into like this miniature doctrine. We all have to watch the Chiefs game. Then they do. If the Chiefs happen to win, which is a 50-50 chance, right? If they happen to win, they say, that was a prophecy. Did you know that? Well, later in sermons, what happens is the quote-unquote prophetic individual who didn't really prophesy, they just said some random statement. But because that random statement came true, they will mention things about the past and then claim that they had prophesied it when they didn't. They just randomly said something. And they will mention it in such a way that the people that they knew who heard them say it will immediately connect the dots. So then those people will uplift whatever was said as prophecy. So suddenly the Chiefs game becomes a prophecy in this scenario. Well, if you're around these kind of people, which I have been, you start to notice that they don't talk like normal people. They say things like that. You just watch. The Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates. It's a random statement. It doesn't really have any meaning whatsoever, you know, unless you're wanting to play the stock market. And if it fails, the casual person would say, well, you're wrong. That failed. But the way that they say it is setting them up for, there's a term in basketball called an alley-oop. They basically throw the ball up so that somebody else will do the alley-oop and claim that, oh, that was a prophecy.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like the exploited version of, you can show a man, you can give a man some fish, but you can teach a man to fish and he can eat his whole life, something like that. It's almost like an exploited version of that where, like to your point, where you're leading people to make their own conclusions, but it's the very conclusions that they want you to make, right? It's kind of like what we've talked about in the past of this primed faith concept where, you know, leaders will use all kinds of different mechanisms and trickery and what have you to prime people's faith to then grab hold of whatever that, you know, cutting edge at the cusp supernatural experience or event is, whether it's a healing or whether it's a release of a, you know, corporate anointing or whatever. But like, yeah, it's like taking things like the Chief game, some very ordinary common event in life and charging it with so much meaning and spiritual and supernatural like couching to where it becomes such a significant event in people's minds that you're right, they build a doctrine around it, they build this meaning around it that like, okay, I'm a part of this because the prophet, I was under the hearing of this prophetic word, this purported prophetic word, so I'm caught up in this very exciting prophetic phenomenon or this unfolding of events. And I'm actually a person who believes that prophecy is a real thing and it's a biblical thing, but it's just that I think a large percentage of what we see now in hyper-charismatic churches is not biblical prophecy. It's like, it could be a mixture. I know we've talked about this before on sources. It could be a mixture of just 100% trickery. It could be a mixture of divination coming from dark sources, or it could be even, some of this could be even people who are gifted in mentalism. You know, there are magicians that are gifted in this kind of stuff, like David Blaine. We've talked about him before, where, you know, he's really well known for going on the streets and doing these face-to-face, you know, magic, this magic stuff that is honestly pretty mind-blowing. But he incorporates mentalism in there, and it's like he can read people's minds. Now, whether he's doing that from, you know, a supernatural source, or it's just a skill he's developed, or a combination of the two, I'm not sure. But like, if you translate that over to the hyper-charismatic church, I feel like there's a mixture of all of those different things in there. And then, but ultimately, what is the, I think the question, the deeper question is, what is the outcome, or what is the impact to the greater body of Christ and the people at large? And I think the impact is, these prophets are bolstered up even further on their pedestals, and they're seen as even more credible because, hey, this man or woman can predict the future. They are walking in a level of superhuman, you know, capability that most of us don't walk in. And so the, you know, the logical outcome of that is these people end up getting more and more influence, more and more money, and more godlike status. And they're practically are worshiped. And I'll say this, Bob Jones was, I told Richard Moore this recently, Bob Jones, the prophet Bob Jones, I would say is probably about as close to worshiping a person as you can get. Like when you, like I was in Morningstar, I was at Bethel, I was in the IHOP circles. He was practically worshiped. I mean, I think probably a close second would be Bill Johnson, as far as like people actually worshiping a person. But I mean, Bob Jones was like seen as this larger than life. I don't know. I don't want to say omniscient, but pretty close to omniscient person that could literally see everything's going to happen in the future. And, you know, there are different theories about him. Was he, did he just have this uncanny ability to speak in gobbledygook to convince people that he knew the future? Or was it all a concocted plan where he and others conspired to like convince people that he was prophetic? Or did he actually have supernatural experiences? And I mean, Bob Scott brings this up in his book that Bob Jones was struck by lightning early on in life. And I think if I remember correctly, Bob Scott thinks that that has something to do with Bob Jones's kind of weird wiring or whatever. So I don't know. There's all these theories out there, but I just think that for those of us that have been in these circles who have sat under the ministries of the prophetic people, it's very disingenuous, actually. Now, I will give Chris Vallotton credit. He did come out and acknowledge that he was wrong about his prophecy about, I think it was a 2020 election. Is that right? I might be getting that wrong. But he did make a video and explain to people that he got it wrong. So I appreciate that. I think that was a good thing. But the fact is, amongst the sea of prophecy, that was an outlier where Chris actually acknowledged that he was wrong. Most of the time, that doesn't happen. Like, people just, you know, if you prophesy something and it doesn't happen, then what they do is they go back and they revise the meaning of what the prophecy was. Well, when we prophesied this the first time, that's not actually what we mean or what we meant by it, even though you can go back and listen to the recording and see that that was what they meant by it. But it's like you reinterpret the meaning to mean something else entirely. Like, this has a different fulfillment or a separate meaning in the future that we have not yet seen. So it's like, I mean, literally, they could take one prophecy and recycle it and use it over and over again to their liking, and to like basically form a conclusion however they want to do. So I don't know. It's like retroactive prophecy, but then retroactive and reusing of prophecy. It's the three R's: retroactive, reuse, and recycle prophecy.
Well, it's actually four R's: and recreate.
Recreate. Okay.
So here's the thing. These movements, these type of movements, have recreated what is the meaning of prophecy. If you understand the Bible, and if you read the Bible, it's very plain. Prophecy is whenever God is speaking using a human as a mouthpiece. So this is God who doesn't exist in time, in our time, who knows the future, the past, the present, who sees everything that we don't see. And when he speaks through the mouthpiece of a prophet, in the Bible, there are examples of how the prophecies were given in symbolic meaning. And they may have seemed somewhat vague at the time they were given to the people. However, there's a significant difference between what they're calling prophecy today and what you see in the Bible. In the Bible, the prophecy given was for the instruction and betterment of the people. Usually, in the Old Testament, it was given because I have given you the set of commandments, I being God. You have deviated from the Mosaic law. You've started to fall into idolatry. And here is the consequences of doing that. So usually it was not even a futuristic prediction. It was just simply, you did this bad thing, and I promised you these blessings if you did the good things, and mm-hmm. these curses if you did the bad things. Usually that's what it was. There were some things that were pointing out events that would happen in the future, but they were for Israel as a whole. It wasn't just simply some guy claimed to be a prophet and walk up to this other guy and said, I expect that you're going to get a bunch of new cattle in your herd because God is going to bless you specifically. It was never something like this. And they do that today. They will go up to a businessman and say, God is going to prosper your business. So give me more tithe because you're going to expect it. I mean, that's usually how weird this gets. But prophecy was given to the people in this vague symbolic form, but whenever the event happened, it fit so perfectly that they would identify this is the fulfillment of that prophecy. So it was vague and become more clear, and that was the progression. So they had scribes that would write down exactly what the prophecy was. They never had to change it. It was set in stone because this came from the mouthpiece of God. When the event happened, they could go back to what was written down by the scribes and compare. Oh, well, this is the event. Clearly, this is the event. In what is, I don't even look at it anymore as though this is some demonic spirit. I know a lot of people do. But if you understand what these guys are doing and how they're doing it, they are trying to speak in vague terms because they're using the vagueness of the prophecies in the Old Testament as their strategy, basically. But what they're doing is they're giving it so vague that it could apply to many different situations. And then whenever a situation comes that almost fits, nearly every prophecy that I have examined by this movement, it never fully fits, but little certain pieces will fit. And they'll say, see, this was my prophecy, and this one element of my entire prophecy fits, so ignore everything that doesn't fit, and we're going to say this is a prophecy. Well, then whenever the next situation occurs, which may fit a different element that didn't fit the first time, they'll reuse that prophecy. But what they're doing essentially is they're recreating the prophecy. So the prophecy is given vague. It becomes more vague and more obscure as time goes on because they're trying to retrofit it for whatever was the event. But again, if you go back to the Bible, it was given in symbolic form. When the event happened, it was so perfectly, every detail would line up, and they'd say, This was our prophecy. This is exactly what happened.
Yeah. No, it's there's so many layers to this. And yeah, the subjectivity / sort of, I think, big target that they paint with the original prophecies is very much the flavor of what happens in the hyper-charismatic churches. Now, there are occasional prophecies that you hear that are very specific. Like, and the examples I'm thinking of are more around the prophetic history of IHOP, like specifically the White Horse prophecy, which related to Pat Bickle, Mike Bickle's brother, who had the accident in the 70s, and he became paralyzed And so the, you know, Bob Jones had this white horse prophecy where, related to, you know, the man on the board and this whole prophecy that when Pat Bickle was healed, it would begin this 1 billion soul harvest, and Kansas City Chiefs were involved in that and all that stuff later on. You know, people still look at that and said, well, look, the Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl a few times. That was part of the prophecy in its later form. But here's what people skip is in the IHOP prophetic history, they actually stopped talking about that portion of the prophecy related to Pat Bickle. It sort of got scrubbed from the prophetic history as you move forward, and it was reinterpreted and reinvented and whatnot. And so this is an example of a very specific prophecy centered around one particular man and his healing, which actually did not happen. He was not healed. And so then the part two of the prophecy related to the billion soul harvest, it's like, well, I think that's probably pretty well disproven at this point, isn't it? Because the specificity of it was quite specific, but the event that was prophesied did not happen. What's interesting, though, is how are you going to validate the 1 billion soul harvest? Think about this. I've thought about this over recent years. You know, why? Okay, first of all, why is it 1 billion? Okay, and how do you measure that? If you're going to have a prophecy that has a number attached to it, there has to be, doesn't there have to be a way to be able to measure that number? And if the answer is yes, then how do you measure that number? Do you measure the 1 billion soul harvest by the number of people who heard the gospel, from people who preached the gospel? Do you measure it by numbers of people who filled out a card in a church service and said they want to believe in Jesus, or they raised their hand in a service? Like, how do you actually measure the 1 billion soul harvest? I think it's the 1 billion soul harvest has been made such a larger than life concept in the NAR that it's like, we just take it for granted. We just like, oh yeah, the billion soul harvest. Yeah. But we don't actually stop to think about what does that actually mean? How do we know if that prophecy is fulfilled? And I think that this is another example of a vague prophecy that you actually cannot validate. Whereas if you look at like the one that comes to mind from the Old Testament, Isaiah 9:6, where he talks about, it's actually a prophecy about Jesus many, many years before Jesus even was born. And it, that's the one where it says the government will rest upon his shoulders. And it's a foretelling of Jesus Christ. Very specific, you know, and, but yet here in this example of the 1 billion soul harvest prophecy, we have a very specific trigger sort of event around Pat Bickle, but then the sort of the event that was prophesied, like the 1 billion soul harvest, was very, very large target that, again, I think it's very difficult to validate whether or not that actually happened or will happen. I mean, I'm of the opinion it's not a real prophecy. I think it was made up. But anyway, just trying to kind of compare, like back to what you said, comparing the examples of prophecy we have now to what's in the Bible. So anyway, yeah, those are just my thoughts on that, around subjectivity and specificity.
There's another aspect of this to consider. Whenever these stage acts, and that's literally how I look at all of these guys, they're just simply stage acts. Whenever they do their prophetic gift or whatever it is that they say that they have, they also combine other verses to negate the testing of that gift. Touch not God's anointed is one example. They'll use that phrase and they'll say, this means you can't test us, you can't question us. Touch not God's anointed means I'm superior and you're inferior. That's essentially what it's saying. But there were multiple descriptions of how to treat prophecy in the Bible. Deuteronomy, I think it's 18, it talks about testing the prophecies. And essentially, if the prophecy came true, then it was a prophecy from God. And if it was false, it was definitely not. You had to test and see, did all of the prophecy come true? In the Latter Rain movement, Branham started claiming that he had predicted that he had this vision of this bridge falling and 16 men fell to their deaths. And there's several elements that you can use this as an example of how this movement was swayed in this wrong direction. So we were able to go back through the records. Fortunately, there was a Coast Guard station set up that was monitoring the entire construction of this bridge. And we were able to determine that 16 men never died on this bridge. It was actually a bridge further upstream that the event happened on. But Branham said in the vision, "I saw a man holding a sign 22, and 22 years to that day, 16 men fell to their deaths." So the first question one must ask is, does it come true? According to the Bible, you have to test it. Was there such a thing? Was it 22 years? And if you go back to, there's actually a lot of documentation on this bridge because the Coast Guard was involved. If you line the dates up, 22 years would have Branham prophesying before he was even born. The bridge wasn't built 22 years later.
Wow.
So
okay.
It fails the test, right?
Yeah, that's a great example.
He said 16 men would fall to their deaths and drown. Well, not a single person were we able to confirm drown. The Coast Guard kept logs of everything, right down to the, we need sandwiches, so we're sending somebody for bread. That's the detail of these logs, right? So it failed the first test. There are other passages, I think it's Deuteronomy 13. It talks about how even if the prophecy comes true, the prophet can still be false if they're leading people away from God. If you examine this bridge prophecy, and this applies to almost all of the prophecies in the NAR, not a single one of those prophecies are leading people to God. They're instead leading people to the prophet.
Yes.
I prophesied this. I'm the one you should look at. Look at me. Right. Look at me. I did the prophecy, yep. Right? Mm-hmm. So it fails number two. There's nothing that could possibly lead me closer to God by learning that 16 men fell to the deaths off of a bridge. Has nothing to do even with me at all, or the city, mm-hmm. or, you know, the whole thing is ridiculous. Also, not many people are aware of this, but if you understand the language that is written about prophets and prophecy, Jesus said, "You'll know them by their fruits." That whole passage is referring to examining a prophet. You have to look at also the moral character of the prophet. They have planted this idea in the minds of the congregations that if they can prophesy and it sounds true and it comes true, then they must be of God, no questions asked. But that's not necessarily true. If you look in the ancient world, you had countless prophets. You had the Oracle of Delphi, which is one of the greatest set of prophets. It wasn't a single person, it was multiple, but very, very accurate according to the histories of the ancient world, and they're not leading people to God. So you can't say this is a prophet of God. This was definitely something else, right? So you have to look at the moral character. And the big thing that is really missed, and I find this odd, because if you look at how the Pentecostal movement developed, they were trying to recreate what is described in the New Testament about how the day of Pentecost came and what happened when the Spirit fell. Well, it is, I think it's Corinthians. It says, "Let the prophet speak, let two or three of them, and let others weigh what is said," which is meaning you're going to have multiple people prophesy, and then people are going to be dedicated to testing the prophecy. Is it 100% accurate, or did it fail? And remember, this is God speaking through the mouth of a person. So if any single detail is off, you can tell that this guy's making it up or this girl's making it up, because God doesn't miss details. That's not how this works. And those simple four things, there's probably more, but if you read through the Bible and you understand how to treat prophets, it's not that you treat them as though they're this untouchable superior being. They're one among you. They're a human like you are. And there might be wolves among the sheep. You have to test them and make sure that they're not a wolf. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
You know, going back to Deuteronomy 18, I actually opened that up here to just take a glance at it. And yeah, it's some pretty strong language that God gives for prophets that come that claim to be speaking for God. You know, and here's a quote just to put us all at ease. Verse 21 of Deuteronomy 18, NIV. You may say to yourselves, how can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? Verse 22, if what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message that the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously, so do not be alarmed. I mean, that's a pretty clear test. Now, some people might say, well, that was the Old Testament. We need to now go to the New Testament to see what does prophecy look like in the New Testament. And I mean, I think that's a fair point. We have the prophet Agabus in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, which he actually prophesied. I believe it was to Paul that you'd be bound up with ropes if you go to such and such place. So there were specificity in what Agabus said. It wasn't like, you, Paul, the apostle, are going to be bound in spiritual ropes and struggles in the demonic principalities, like some flowery language. Like it was a very specific indicator that you could actually look at and know whether it comes to pass or not, right? So very measurable and very objective. And as you're talking, John, I was thinking about what came to mind back to the specificity thing, and you're probably familiar with this. It is the, at least in our worlds of the NAR, it was the prophecy of Paul Kane about the earthquake in 1988. And Jack Deere and his son Stephen Deere in particular have talked about this publicly in the past couple of years. You can check out the article on Divine Detours. And I know you've talked to Stephen before, John, on your podcast. But there's the story told about when Paul Kane asked Jack Deere to introduce him to John Wimber. And then, you know, the meeting was scheduled, and this was in the summer of 1988, when the Deers moved out to Anaheim, California, to be on John Wimber's staff. And Paul Kane said that the Lord showed him that there would be an earthquake in Southern California on the day he arrived in Anaheim. And the interesting thing is, there was an earthquake, as I understand it. There was an earthquake that happened in Armenia. And then there was another earthquake that happened, I believe, in SoCal. Correct me if I'm wrong. But the one in Armenia was very, very destructive. There were a lot of people that died. The one in Southern California, I don't know. But the thing about Southern California, as everybody who's lived in California knows this, and I have lived in California, Northern California, but even in Northern California, we had a lot of seismic activity. But Southern California especially, you have a ton of seismic activity happening all the time. So here's the question. What is the probability? Like, statistically, I would love to know, on any given day in Southern California in 1988, what would be the probability of a large earthquake hitting that region? You know, is it one out of a million? Is it one out of 10,000? Is it one out of a thousand? One out of 100? And then you take a step further and you're like, well, define large earthquake. how do you know what is a large earthquake? Is it 4.0 on the Richter scale? Is it 5.0? And then the next question is, how deep is the earthquake? Because we know that you can have a very high rating on the Richter scale of an earthquake, but if it's really deep, it won't create as much damage on the surface. So these are all the questions I'm asking in my brain. Was it coincidental that two earthquakes happened? They actually did. It's recorded in history. You can look it up. Is that coincidental? Did Paul Kane have some kind of, and I can just tell, John, you've got a lot of opinion about this. I can't wait to hear. What is that? Like, what's going on here? Is this an example of coincidence? Is this an example of maybe Paul Kane got one right? I don't know. I legitimately don't know. I'm dying to know what you think.
Well, back to my Chiefs game. If I were to have sat there and watched a pre-show game where I was watching about the other team and I saw that their star quarterback is out, they had to put in second string, and their defensive line, a couple guys are sick or broken legs, and I knew that the other team was heavily crippled, then if I were to randomly say, you watch, the Chiefs are going to win this game, it really means nothing because I've watched the pregame show and I know that the other team has a strong disadvantage. Well, to anyone who doesn't live in Southern California or hasn't spent any significant amount of time, who is unaware how many earthquakes happen in California per day, it's not just one or two. I mean, we're talking,
right.
You can pull up a map and you can see it is, if I were to predict that an earthquake is going to happen tomorrow, I might actually get it right.
Yeah.
Because it just continually happens.
Sure.
It sits right there on the San Andreas Fault.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people also didn't know this when Kane was throwing these random predictions. Armenia also has a fault line going right through it. So what you see in Southern California, you also see in Armenia. And if you apply that to the global scale, which he did, I can predict that tomorrow an earthquake's going to happen. And I'm going to be right because somewhere in the world, some country is going to have an earthquake. That's the way the world we live in works. But that's how these people do it. And again, take it back to those criteria that I mentioned before. How does it help the church to know that there is an earthquake going to happen? What good does that do? What value is that to the church?
Right.
How does it better the church? Instead, it's pointing to prophecy as basically pointing to the prophet as the ultimate authority. And it's pointing people to him instead of God. So this is actually failing one of the criterias.
That's a great point. Thank you for saying that. It's not just about the event. Like, let's say, okay, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's say it was, you know, potentially a legit prophecy. Okay. You know, okay. But like, yeah, part two, like how many people came to the Lord or who chose to follow Jesus Christ because of this earthquake prophecy? That is a great point. And my next sort of snark comment question is, well, how do you know? Like, how do you know if somebody's getting pointed towards God in this situation? And I don't know. I mean, that's probably a subjective question. It's probably a different answer for everybody, every different person, just depending on that person's experience. But still, like, if you boil it down and you just look at it at face value, like, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think probably the result was that Paul Kane was elevated in his sort of position and his believability and validation as a prophet, you know, and it wouldn't be long after this it was during this time that the Kansas City Prophets were sort of in their heyday in Kansas City. And so sort of helped to, I think, probably bolster his position in that sort of circle and, you know, contribute to the prophetic history of IHOP. So, and then other, you know, circles and groups too. But yeah, it's very perplexing. Like, I like to look at both sides of the argument and really give it an honest look and not just, you know, say, oh, okay, well, it's all just bad. Let's throw it all out. Like, I actually want to give each side of the argument the benefit of the doubt and think about it critically. I would love to know what the statistical probability is, though, of an earthquake, a major earthquake happening at any given day in Southern California, more specifically 1988. And I'm sure Grok or ChatGPT could tell us.
According to ChatGPT, the probability is 100%.
100%.
I mean, if you look at the map, you understand why it's like this. Every single day, there's going to be an earthquake somewhere. And, you know, so let's take a step back at this. Kane was William Branham's protege. Mm-hmm. Branham got ejected from Germany and I don't know how many other countries. Kane is the one that Branham would send in his stead. He was literally that guy, right? Mm-hmm. He started working with Branham in the mid-50s. I think it was the mid-50s he started working with Branham. So he would have been around for what I'm about to say. Around the mid-50s, there were a lot of things that started to happen quickly. One of which was Branham took on the leadership of the homosexual William T. Freire von Blumberg, who was one of the directors for the Fellowship Foundation, otherwise known as the Family. And they were planting family organizations all around the globe, apparently. And he was openly homosexual to his inner circle. Kane was also, and other people we have connected to this were as well. And all that to say, each one of the men who were involved in this inner circle was preaching strongly against homosexuality while working with known homosexuals. So all that to say, they were speaking out of both sides of their mouth. They weren't doing what it was that they were saying, which if you understand by their fruits you shall know them, all of the passages that are related to that, they're actually failing one of the critiques for being a prophet. Jim Jones is one of the people who started working with them at the same time. That's the level of nasty that this gets. Well, it is during the mid-50s that William Branham took one of his old alleged prophecies and kind of twisted and rewrote it. During the early, it would have been in the early 40s to mid-40s, there were men who were claiming that Mussolini was going to lead people to the end of days destruction because of the Christian identity doctrine. They believed that the false Jews had invaded the United States. Mussolini and Rome was the other part of this equation. That would lead to Armageddon, etc. And Branham admits, well, you can find this on recording, he admits to almost having been arrested for this. Why? There were several people who were involved in this conspiracy that were part of what became the Great Sedition Trial of 1944. They were essentially trying to sway the American public against the government and cause a mass sedition. So Branham admits to being part of this, and he claims that he had some prophecy surrounding this. Well, he was one of hundreds who were making the same claims. Fast forward to 1950s. Branham then, in the mid-1950s, claimed that he had a series of prophecies in the year 1933, which included that Mussolini prophecy. He claims that he wrote them all down on a piece of paper and then buried it for no one to see. So if you go back to the scriptural example of a prophet, the prophets had scribes that would write things down so that when the event happened, they knew that that was the event that happened by God. They didn't hide them for no one to see. And years later, we have discovered that not only did he not bury them, the cornerstone that they were buried in was dug up twice in the history of it and found to be empty. The details that he got in those prophecies weren't the same from retelling to retelling of what are the seven prophecies. They changed and evolved over time. They grew, they morphed. Where I'm headed with this is people like Paul Kane were there with Branham when he would say, do you remember when I prophesied about this female vice president, which wasn't one of the original seven? People who were with him, who thought him to be the end of days messenger from God, they were studying what he said, everything that he said. So in the 50s, they suddenly came to be aware of these 1933 prophecies. They would have scrambled to learn more. Well, why didn't he tell us this until 1950s? Then when they got the original seven, the moment in which he mentions an eighth and drops one of the first original seven, they would have stood back and said, what in the world? That's not the seven that I have. I'm studying this because I think this is the messenger from God. But the way that Branham did this was, and with the men that he was working with, was with such deception that the men who were with him, Cain included, were fully aware that he wasn't being truthful about even having the seven prophecies. There's clear evidence that he never even had a single prophecy. They were aware of this, but what they did was they watched the way that he introduced after the fact, retroactive, or, you know, whatever is the word that you used in the beginning of this.
Retroactive prophecy.
Retroactive prophecy. He did this, and they watched the people believe it. But not only that, they watched the people believe it and start sending in large sums of money. So then this turns into this big scheme, this basically religious racketeering is what this is. It turned into this, and they saw the power of claiming prophecy, but more than that, they saw that the power he had over the individuals to believe him as a prophet, no matter whether it's true or not. They wanted to adopt this and create a movement that was far, far larger in scope than even what Branham created. Cain helped create this.
This is mind-blowing. Okay, what you're describing here, among other things, is first and foremost spiritual abuse at the highest level, right? Because yes, you're talking about deception that it's deception that intersects with human agency, and it hijacks a person's belief in God, and it causes that person's agency to be exploited and supplanted by the man of God, you know, prophet person. And then you wake up 20 years later after being in it, and you're like, my entire internal spiritual structure has been hijacked, right? And you multiply that by like hundreds of thousands of people that have now been impacted by the offshoots of the original message organization, the NAR. But like back to what you said, that is a perfect example. That's crazy though. I've heard you talk about this before, like with the 1933 prophecy with William Branham and how they dug up the, you know, the stone and there was no paper. You know, there's nothing there that was recorded. This is a perfect example of retroactive prophecy. And other prophetic people have done this around other geopolitical events, namely 9/11. Okay. I can't even tell you how many people I've run across, and I'm sure you have too, prophetic people who conveniently announced to the general public that they had a dream or vision after the fact about 9/11, right? So even years later, like some of these are even recent, like in the past 5 years. Hey, by the way, y'all, I had a dream where I saw the towers get hit by airplanes, and they all, you know, fell down and disappeared and exploded. All these people died. And it's like, I mean, really, like, you know, this is probably the most severe terrorist attack our country has faced ever. And you're getting on the horn and saying, oh, yeah, I knew about this beforehand. Well, if you knew about it beforehand, why didn't you tell us? Why did you not bother to warn us? And you know, and I think some of these guys are so steeped in their believing, you know, drinking their own Kool-Aid that they actually say, well, I did warn y'all. I gave y'all all these prophetic words beforehand, you know, if you were spiritual, you would have been able to interpret this and you could have avoided loss of life or something or some whatever, you know. And it's like, this to me is the ultimate grift, because you're actually using events that happened already in the past. Okay, again, going back to my original point, it is 2025, and I could get on YouTube or some other platform and say I'm a prophet, and I could tell y'all, you know what? I had a dream that COVID was going to happen. I had a dream that this new virus that nobody has ever heard of, that doctors have never even seen before, was going to take over the world. It was going to be this worldwide pandemic, and all these people are going to die. And I saw all this back in 1994, you know, and I saw dark clouds coming over the United States and all these people dying from this virus that would make you cough and you would lose your, I hate to be graphic, but this is the kind of stuff they say, like, people can't breathe. They have to have respirators. And the next thing you know, you've got family members that are dying of a virus that you've never heard of before. And, but like, this is exactly what they do. They will take a historical event that has already occurred. They will claim that they knew about it beforehand by reason of prophetic revelation, whether it be vision, dream, or visitation or something else. And because I knew about it, I'm validated as a prophet. I am to be followed. I am to be listened to. I am to be believed. And by the way, to your point, I am to be given much money to. Like, you need to write your checks to me because I need to be able to fund my ministry to be able to continue telling you about all the future events that haven't yet happened.
So let me blow your mind even further.
Please.
So in the late 1940s, right about the time Latter Rain is getting ready to explode, William Branham starts to say, "You may not have known this, people," he's speaking to the audience, "but the very day that the Lord sent his angel down to me and met me in that room alone with this angel to give me the gift of divine healing, that day was the same exact day that Israel became a nation." And he gives it a year, and people who are listening think, oh my gosh, this is symbolic, this is spiritual, because Israel. Well, the year he gives wasn't the year that Israel became a nation.
No so
he
way.
Was, he was just pulling it out of his butt.
So what year did he claim that Israel became a nation?
I'll just read you the quote. He says, "And a strange thing of that you might not know, the very day the angel of the Lord called me out, May the 6th, 1947, and issued the gift to pray for the sick, was the very same day that Israel became a nation for the first time." So he's using the date May the 6th, 1947. Here's where it gets a little bit funny. The very first recording of a faith healing ministry that we're allowed to hear, there are recordings that pre-exist this, the very first one that is in the tape index is April 1947. So he's having these these divine healing lines before the alleged angel met him.
Oh.
But where I'm headed with this is somewhere entirely different.
Interesting.
William Branham, we came across a book that was written by William Branham, a little pamphlet that was dated 1945, and he gives the date in his letter. He's got a preface letter, and he says, "This day, this angel, this vision has come to me and has given me this new commission to heal the sick." So that's in 1945. He's mentioning that he's healing the sick, so he's got a divine commission way before his 1947 claim. In that letter, he describes having a gift of healing starting, I think the date goes back to 1936. And he says, "And then the gift left me, and then it came back." But there's a critical point that he mentions in this book. He says, "In the vision, I was told to go out west because the people in the tabernacle would no longer eat my bread." So symbolically, he's saying that the people in his church aren't listening to him. And people who are not familiar with the history of the Branham Tabernacle do not realize the Branham Tabernacle had this significant turnover. People were coming, and they would sit for a while, and then they would never return again. So whenever he says things like, "Do you remember back in that day when I prophesied, you people were there, you were hearing it." Well, most of the people that he's speaking to weren't there.
Interesting.
They didn't know it. The ones who were there, they quit coming because they knew that this guy just lied through his teeth. Why would I come back to this liar who's saying this? But those statements are recorded. So every future generation that hears those recordings, they think that he's being truthful. And here's the point I'm trying to make, which not many people understand this. For these types of people, Branham, Bickle, all of the ones who are pulling this prophetic nonsense, they don't really care if what they say is true. They don't even care if the audience believes that it's true, because the audience that do not believe will leave eventually, and they'll be replaced with people who do. And the people who are replaced can go back and they can see it's either written form, it's recorded form, whatever it is. They'll go back and say, wow, everybody that I'm in this new church with, not knowing that this turnover exists, they all believe the same thing. I must believe it too.
Okay, you learned me something. You learned me something, John. So, okay, let's go back. You said May 6th, 1947.
Right. He said it was May the 6th, 1947. And you can go back. I mean, this is fully documented. You can go through the history of the state of Israel. It was May 14th, 1948.
48, yeah. I'm looking at the Office of the Historian of the U.S. State Department, and it says May 14th, 1948 was when Israel became a nation. So he was 1 year and 7 days early.
Yeah, but keep in mind, like, he's saying this to people who have already just kind of adopted everything that he said. Yeah. Those people who recognize that, wait a minute, that's not even true, they would have just left.
They're not there.
They're not there even anymore. There. Yeah.
Okay, this is what this is what I want to say. The thing you learned me right now. So when I go back and I look at the structure and organization of all three trifecta hyper-charismatic churches I was a part of, right? So for me, it was Morningstar, IOPKC/Metro Christian Fellowship, and then Bethel. Every one of those organizations' orbits is very similar to what you described in that, but it's anchored around now schools of ministry and conferences, right? And so you've heard the concept conference church. Well, what happens is just what you described in the Branham organization, you have volumes and volumes of people coming, and you have volumes and volumes of people leaving. It's literally like a revolving door. Now, you do have some people that are long, you know, lifers or whatever, people that stick around for a while. And, you know, we still know a number of them at Bethel that are in leadership and staff and what have you. They've been there for a good long time. But by and large, people come and people go in great number. You know, whether it's they spend a year, they spend 6 months, they might spend 3 weeks or 5 years, whatever. For us, it was 4 years at Bethel. But it's a great observation because to exactly what you said, like the people that would have been there at the time that these original things were spoken, a lot of them may not be there anymore. Even though now I think we have a lot more volume of material that's recorded, both audio and video, than they did back then. So it's easier to kind of, you know, it's easier to see through that than it was back then, probably. But still, like, there are plenty of people who are still drinking the Kool-Aid. Like, they're coming in, they're staying, and then maybe they get disillusioned or they leave or whatever, and they, you know, and they're out. And you got a whole crop of new people coming in. But I will say this about Bethel. I've been hearing from credible sources that, and this is just what I've been hearing, I don't know if it's true or not, I'm just saying, like, take this with a grain of salt, that enrollment of BSSM, Bethel School of Supernatural Ministry, is kind of going down. It's been kind of on a downtrend. And I just wonder, like, is it because word is getting out that more and more of the scandals is, you know, being made public? There's been more hubbub at Bethel here this year around Sean Boltz, the grift, the fake prophecy data mining that Sean Boltz did. There's been stuff with Bob Hartley over there. And, you know, and so you just wonder, like, is that impacting the incoming pipeline of people? And I'm just interested in the numbers, like, and it's hard to prove this because these numbers aren't really public, like, as far as how many people are coming into the Bethel orbit now versus, like, maybe 5 years ago, for example. And is that notably different? Is it comparable or what? I would love to know what those numbers are. I don't know what they are, but I would venture to say, based on what I've heard, that the numbers have decreased. But that being said, Bethel still has tremendous influence and resources worldwide in their reach. So even if they did have a downtick in pipeline of people coming in, you know, that may not make a huge difference in the grand scheme of things as far as their influence on large numbers of people.
I think it's a combination of things, and it brings me actually to my last point. So you have this turnover. People who recognize that this whole thing is a scam, they leave and new people come. And anybody who's in the prophetic can say, do you remember when I said, well, half the people weren't there, so they didn't hear it. But the people who were, who come, who believe this, they get under this level of mind control where they're part of the system, even though that they can recognize there are cracks in the walls of the system. They have been indoctrinated. So when they do leave, when they come across something that causes them to leave, they don't throw it all away. They don't realize that they've been scammed. Instead, they'll take whatever's the thing that they found wrong, and they'll say, well, this is problematic. I'm going somewhere else. When they do, they take with them their indoctrination. And because they're in this apostolic network that is under the umbrella of the NAR, they usually go to another church that's in the same network.
Yeah.
Who's doing the same exact thing, mm-hmm. who, you know, they're saying, do you remember when I said, yeah. Well, then they're already indoctrinated from the first church. They go to the second and they immediately accept it and believe it rather than use critical thinking. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem that cascades and grows over time with the individuals that go from church to church. But that, mm-hmm. that is a topic, I think, for another day.
Yeah, we should talk about that more, like the migration. I know we've talked about cross-pollination before, and that's definitely part of my story too. Like, I hop between three different ones and then some. So yeah, it happens. Yours truly did that. So so guilty as charged. But yeah, we should talk about that sometime.
Awesome. Well, this has been fun. Thank you for doing this.
Of course. Absolutely happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and the Grit in the Wild podcast. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.